Hello, listeners around the world. Welcome to Salon Radio, broadcasted in New York City at Funkadelic Studios. This is Heidi Russell, founder of International Women Artists Salon, the producer of this Salon Radio series, and it is my distinct pleasure to be the host today. And we have a great show. It's a little extra long today, so we hope that you will enjoy this extra time to be with two amazing women creatives that are doing fantastic work out there. And we'll tell you a little bit more about them as we move through the show. But first, as always, we'd like to bring to you our World Bulletin, what is happening for women artists around the world. And today, Maureen Bantries, our editor-in-chief of our Salon Bulletins and World Bulletins, has written today's bulletins. So here we go with the World Bulletin. Take it away, Maureen.
Hello, Salonistas. This is Maureen Bantries bringing you the World Bulletin. First up, we have the Whitney Museum of American Art. Its fantastic presentation of women's creative work currently on display, along with the curators and assistant curators. Five are solo exhibitions of these talented women: Lorna Mills with her Caught in Moment through October 2nd, Willa Nazatir, emerging artist, through October 1, Addie Wegenecht with Believe Me, Bunny Rogers, Brig und Ladder Mixed Media Animation through October 9th, and Sybil Kempson, 12 Shouts to the 10 Forgotten Heavens, every solstice and equinox through 2018. Next one is September 22nd, 2017. There are more women in this exhibit as well, including An Incomplete History of Protest with online exhibition image of Annette Lemieux's Black Mass from 1991. An Incomplete History of Protest looks at how artists from the 1940s to the present have confronted the political and social issues of their day. Assistant curators are Jenny Goldstein and Rahiko Hockley. More at whitney.org. And then IWASP partner organization, The Anthropologists, has recently been in the news. Most recently, they had a production back in July called The Anthropologists Save the World. The Anthropologists are a company of artists dedicated to the creation of investigative, socially relevant, engaging theatrical work, using physical theater and contemporary dance to devise organic ensemble-based work. So back in July, their production of The Anthropologists Save the World brought three plays together, fusing explosive anecdotes, absurd interludes, and invigorating movement. One of them was called The Lecture, about a smoker cessation group resurrecting Aldous Huxley. We had The Blackout, where doomsday preppers take on the biggest blackout in New York history, and The Robot, imagining a not-so-distant future where a child finds himself in a country overrun by robots where humans are merely accessories in the New World Order. And most recently, for the anthropologists, with the support of the Artist Co-op, they organized an emergency artist response session to the events in Charlottesville. That was August 17th. They and IWASP condemned these vile and hateful acts, and they felt it necessary to provide an open and productive space for communities to come together and process the events. They had a discussion open to people of every race, creed, color. They had a brainstorming session, writing about their reactions and specific examples of works, artistic works that educate, having discussion based on those things, sharing artistic responses, brainstorming and planning projects, and working toward making those projects happen. And lastly, we find that Wonder Woman is now the largest grossing superhero movie ever at $800 million in box office sales worldwide. And the great thing is, it just came out on digital August 29th and will be coming out on Blu-ray September 19th. Congratulations to actress Gal Gadot and director Patty Jenkins. And that'll wrap it up for our World Bulletin.
Thank you so much, Maureen. As you can hear, there is incredible work being done by women creatives in all disciplines around the world, and this is just a little sampling of what's happening. So we would love to hear from you. Let us know what's happening for the women's artistry in your neck of the woods, in your area of the world. Please email us at womenartsalon@gmail.com. to let us know, and we'll collaborate and get those messages out to the rest of the world through Salon Radio and all of our other social media. You can find us on International Women Artists Salon fan page on Facebook, on Twitter at Women Art Salon, on Instagram at Women Art Salon. And stay tuned for a new website that's coming out. But in the meantime, you can also find out more about International Women Artists Salon on our blogspot, which is womenartsalon.blogspot.com. So thank you for being a supporter of women's artistry out there by listening to Salon Radio. And if you're new, we hope that you will become engaged with us in any way. Join us, partner with us, sponsor us, and give us ideas of how we can collaborate in all parts of the world. So it is also my distinct pleasure to be able to present our first guest today. And I've worked with an amazing public relations professional, Esther Kashkin, and she has been amazing, bringing great women creatives to International Women Artists Salon. So thank you, Esther. And our first guest today comes from the opera world, and I'm going to introduce her and her project that she has going on, and we'll talk a little bit about those projects and the inspiration that has led to these great projects and activity. So welcome to Andrea Del Giudice. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Heidi. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, it's our great pleasure and honor. And you're calling in from Chicago, is that correct?
I am indeed, yes. Temporarily, I'm from New York City, but I'm here visiting and setting up my daughter at college.
Fantastic. Who is a woman creative in her own right, I believe. So we look forward to hopefully getting her on Salon Radio in the future.
And indeed.
We wish her the best. So Andrea is director of La Traviata and founder and artistic director of New York Opera Collaborative. And we're going to talk most extensively today about her current project, directing a new version of La Traviata. And Giuseppe Verdi's operatic masterpiece, La Traviata, based on Alexandre Dumas Villa's popular play, has remained one of the most popular operas of the standard repertory, both before and after Richard Gere took Julia Roberts to the opera in Pretty Woman, another story about a streetwalker with a heart of gold. In Hollywood, La Traviata was famously filmed by the great Italian director Franco Zeffirelli, with a starry cast led by Placido Domingo as Alfredo and Teresa Stratas as Violetta. Fully costumed and staged, La Traviata will be directed by Andrea, with a live orchestra conducted by Jason Tram, starring Susan Burgess and Ashley Bell as Violetta, and Christopher Nelson as Alfredo, Jonathan Scott as Germont, and lighting design by Greg Solomon and set designed by Fred Sorrentino. And I apologize ahead of time that my Italian is very rustic, and I'm sure Andrea will help correct any of my pronunciations through the show. So
I think the only one we're going to start with, Heidi, is Violetta. She's the, of course, my main character, and in the Italian language, the letter I is pronounced. So Violetta is how that's pronounced.
Violetta, there we go.
Beautiful.
Thank you. And we're actually going to hear Ashley Bell as Violetta in some of recordings that we will be listening to during this feature as well. And I want to mention a little bit about Andrea first before we get into more detail about her projects and her work. Andrea is a renowned international operatic soprano and New York City-based voice teacher. She is founder and artistic director of New York Opera Collaborative, artistic director of the International Vocal Arts Festival in Narni, Italy, vocal director at the Neighborhood Playhouse of the Theater in New York City, and highly sought after private studio in New York City. And she also was recently appointed to the advisory board of Del Arte Opera Ensemble of New York City, whose members include New York City agents, directors, conductors from Chicago Lyric Opera, Metropolitan Opera, West Edge Opera, Yale University, and renowned singers, and is currently serving as founder and artistic director, as I mentioned, of the New York Opera Collaborative, which we're going to hear a little bit more about. And so, Andrea, we always like to ask our guests first a little bit, tell us a little bit about how you found your creative voice initially and how it's developed over time.
Thank you. Well, I have been in the international operatic world as a soprano, as a performer for many years, and had been asked on many occasions to direct. They always sort of shied away from direction, having been used to being on stage and interpreting a role in my own way amongst the concept of a director that I was working with. And recently, I was approached by Jason Tram, the conductor of our production, as possibly directing La Traviata. And as I thought about it, I really feel that at this point in my life and in my career, I've learned so much as a director and a human being that I thought I had something to offer in telling the story of La Traviata from Violetta's eyes, from her experience in society, what it means to attempt your life in a city like New York City, which is where my production is set. And equally as importantly, in a time where we are living amongst a presidency which has brought back some very, very difficult times for women. I think I described it as, you know, a return to the world as Barbie. And that's just not where I wanted to come from in terms of what I wanted to bring to La Traviata. So my hope is that through my sort of my inspiration for this production came very much from what's going on societally right now. And as I said, with a president that is not pro-feminism, as we can certainly say. So I'm hopeful that as we talk about the production today, I can bring that around to something that would touch many of us as women and the importance of our voices being heard.
Absolutely, Andrea. And we will definitely delve into that. And you mentioned a little bit about your past career as a singer as well. Can you tell us a little bit about, how you determined that you wanted to be an opera singer and maybe give us a little inspiration for those budding singers out there who are considering opera and tell us a little bit who you've performed with.
Absolutely. I actually started as a pianist through high school and started my college years as a pianist and then was dared to audition for an opera, which was hilarious because I'd never done anything like it. I'd always sung in choirs and actually I did a lot of dinner theater type things, but I'd never sung opera. So I auditioned in college and lo and behold, and surprisingly to me, I got the lead role in Hansel and Gretel as Hansel. So I tried my hand at opera and I loved it. I just loved being on stage and as opposed to being locked in a practice room, practicing 8 hours a day. And I changed my major. And from there, I just became more and more passionate about being on stage in this tremendously passionate and inspirational music that these composers, and particularly Italian composers. My career has been based in mostly the Puccini and Verdi operas. I sing most of the heroines, Madame Butterfly, Nini La Boheme, Manon Lescaut. I've done just about all of the Verdi and the Puccini. So I've played many of the women who either die of consumption or are murdered, or in many cases, the stories where the woman is depicted as the victim. And so it's an interesting turn of events for me that I've chosen an opera where the lead character generally dies of consumption. Consumption seems to be a big disease in opera. I don't know why, but that's what it's called. So I've taken a different turn. I mean, I've sung major operas with Johann Botta. I've sung Otello with Placido Domingo. I won the Pavarotti competition. I've sung with many, many international singers. I spent 4 years in Bonn at the Opera di Stadt Bonn with Giancarlo Delmonico, the famous son of Mario Delmonico. So I've had a very prolific career and met many people and lived in many countries. So I'm very excited to bring a little bit more of an updated an updated approach to this project. And I work with young singers, mainly the cast that I'm working with right now. They're varying ages, but generally from, I'd say, like 25 to 35. So I've got a very young cast and varying different levels. My baritone, Jonathan Scott, is currently at the Metropolitan Opera. My sopranos, Ashley Bell and Suzanne Burgess, they're performing in many, many different venues and regional companies as well. So everyone's at slightly a different level, which is part of the pleasure of bringing everyone together creatively. It's really watching them grow at the level that they're at. Of course, they're all auditioned and chosen from many, many different singers who had auditioned. And we're extremely, extremely happy with the cast that we've assembled.
Fantastic. Well, you do indeed have a illustrious and prolific career. And congratulations on all that you've accomplished today. And we're certainly looking forward to the next stages as you directing and getting the voices of the women in opera to be heard in a different light. And bravo for taking that step. And I just can't wait to hear more, and literally hear more, not just in this interview, but in the future and following your career and your productions. And I just wanted to touch a little bit more on your work as a vocal coach. You just mentioned a little bit about that, but as I mentioned, several other listeners out there might be, you know, currently taking voice lessons and whatnot. Can you talk a little bit about your work as a vocal coach?
Absolutely. I'm actually a voice teacher, and there is a difference between the two.
Okay.
A vocal coach is generally someone who is a pianist, and normally coaching both linguistically and musically the actual content of the opera. It's not that I couldn't do that, but my work and my studio is based in my work as a vocal technician. I specifically teach physiological vocal technique, which is derivative of the Italian bel canto school in which I studied myself. So my students will come in and bring a role or an aria or something they're working on, and we're working on the actual sound production, the physical requirements of the body and the voice in terms of, you know, developing it. This is opera singers, I think, more than anyone else, spend so many years of their training. I know that Pavarotti studied with the same voice teacher for over 35 years. Same with Barbara Freni and some of the big singers, Beverly Sills. They found a vocal technician that they trusted, that understood their voice, and so they worked with that teacher once a week for the extent of their careers. So that's a little bit different, as I say. However, equally as important to have both a vocal technician and a vocal coach to become a well-rounded singer and to learn expressively and technically exactly what that composer intended. I always say that opera is sort of the necessity to be the triple threat. You have to be a technically proficient singer at your languages and as well as an actor. So it combines a lot of the mediums of our art form.
Indeed it does. And thank you for the explanation of the difference between the vocal coach and vocal technician and how important they both play a role in developing one's career as an opera singer. And can you tell us a little bit about, about your other work with the Narnia Festival?
Yes, I lived in Italy for 7 years, and my daughter was actually born in Rome while I was singing over there. And upon returning to the States, I had some productions that I was doing here, and I ended up moving to New York City. And actually, kind of at the same time, my daughter entered Juilliard. She did her undergraduate work at Juilliard. And when I arrived, I met a wonderful, wonderful pianist by the name of Cristiana Pegoraro, an Italian woman from Narni, Italy. And she was doing a series of concerts in New York City. And at the time, I was the head of the resident artist program for Da Capo Opera Theater with Michael Capasso. Michael Capasso has since renovated and is now the executive director of the new New York City Opera. So I've worked with him for a number of years. He introduced me to Cristiana, and we immediately felt this tremendous energy together. And she had already had the Narnia Festival up and running as an instrumental program. But when I suggested to her, let's build an operatic program, she said that would be fantastic. So we spent, we just finished our fourth year, with productions of Johnny Skeeky and Suor Angelica this past summer, with a wonderful director, Maria Rosario Maggio, who's a very, very well-known actress in Italy, and she works quite often with Woody Allen, and she also brought a tremendous women's perspective to particularly the Suor Angelica production, and the importance that all women inside and internally have this sense of mother, which brings such a strength to society. And really, it was breathtaking. I mean, I've sung Suor Angelica myself, and after like every day of rehearsals, I was still crying at rehearsals. So
oh, wow.
That's how I knew she really hit the mark. So Narnia is a 4-week festival in July every year, and we have multiple mediums going on there. We have, of course, the opera program and the full scale opera with orchestra, costumes, everything. We have flamenco, we have tango, we have symphonic concerts. We do a mass in both the Narni Cathedral and the Orvieto Cathedral. So it's this little tiny city, which of course was where the Narnia Chronicles was based, the city.
Oh,
and
okay.
It just has churches and cathedrals and small little chapels and performance spaces all over the place. So it's in Umbria, which is of course beautiful, the rolling hills, prosciutto, and all the wonderful things that Narni can bring in that regard. But we're really excited. And as I think I mentioned to you earlier in a pre-interview today, I was thinking and thought, my gosh, it's a completely female artistic staff now. And I think I always wanted to be that way, but after 4 years, I finally have together. Now, I also have to mention that Maestro Jason Tram is such a welcome, brilliant, sensitive, wonderful collaborator with us, and he conducted the operas this year. So it's developed into quite a large festival, and I'm very proud of the work that we're doing.
Fantastic. Esther had told me a little bit about the festival in the past, and it's great to hear a little bit more detail about it. And I definitely need to put on my calendar to do some travel in July.
We'd love to have you.
Absolutely. And Andrea, I'd like to have you touch a little bit about your collaborative organization, New York Opera Collaborative, and I know you're one of the founders, and can you tell us how that came together? And
sure.
You
know, living...
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, excuse me. Living in New York City and the environment of operatic, let's just say opera as my chosen sport, it's, you know, opera companies have been closing, and that's a well-known fact, and I felt in working with many, many directors and students and companies, that the idea of collaborating is just such an important basis. Being on the advisory board of the Dell'Arte Opera Ensemble, and I just saw their productions like last week, they were absolutely exquisite. They did such a wonderful job with budget and all of the challenges that there is to keeping, you know, opera alive in our society and financing these projects. I think we've all found the need at one time or another to collaborate with other organizations. So my idea was to bring this to a new level by focusing the collaborative on first and foremost bringing young artists together who had the need to learn roles in its most complete way, with me technically, vocally, and now in the direction side, Jason Tram as a conductor, and then my other partner, Peter Ransman of Ransman Artist Management, who has been in the business for over 30 years, represents tremendous, tremendous singers, many at the Metropolitan Opera, Chicago Lyric, you know, La Scala. He works with many major, major artists. And we thought it would be wonderful to bring the three of us together and offer, during the rehearsal period, also this type of coaching aspect to the young singers. We also are basing our initial sort of preview performances at the National Opera Center in New York City and therefore the singers get a chance to perform in a concert setting before they go off to do it staged. This way I can also help to promote smaller projects from other opera companies like Loft Opera, Bear Opera, Del Arte. These are all wonderful, wonderful smaller companies that have popped up around New York City, Heartbeat Opera, and they're getting wonderful reviews from the New York Times and et cetera, et cetera. So bringing all of these artists and, you know, creative teams together seem to be something that would help, again, grow opera again from sort of the younger singers up. I mean, as we say in society, we want our next generation to be bringing forward not only the art form, but also some of the traditions. And the traditions for me would be in the basis of learning from the grassroots, as opposed to, I have to say this, I probably sound old by saying this, but as opposed to the electronics, the real live art form. And that's been a real focus of my work and the direction in which New York Opera Collaborative is taking.
That's fantastic, and it's so good to hear that there is an effort out there to sort of quote-unquote save opera, because I had heard that as well over through the years living here in New York City, that how the audiences and the audience going was decreasing and the houses closing. So it's so good to hear that there's this concerted effort to keep opera alive and the traditions, but also making it relevant to today and bringing in the new younger generations into mm-hmm. this fantastic storytelling realm. And you mentioned, I think, in some of your material talking about social consciousness and merging that with the older works and then bringing that to today's mm-hmm. Relevancy as well. So I
yes,
think we're
and in the production of La Traviata in particular, I felt that as a young girl growing up, I was very, very connected to Sylvia Plath and Sylvia Plath's work. I also read a book when I was probably 8 years old or so called Gay Paris. It later became a film with Judy Garland and Robert Goulet. And it was, I can't believe it. It just sort of came to me about 2 months ago that this was actually the story of La Traviata, the traditional story, and also the Lady of the Camellias, which was this cat, Violetta, of course, is a character, but this cat, Musette, who was looking for a life and ended up being found by what we would traditionally think of as a call girl operation, and trained to then become a bride to be purchased by this other American cat. And what's so ironic is that I used to have my mom read me this book every single day, every day. And I always wanted the story to end differently. And I think that's why I wanted it read to me every day. And even at that age, I knew there was something wrong with it. And I think as I got older into my teens and I was reading the Sylvia Plath work, I felt the same, that this incredibly talented, vital woman who suffered from a mental illness, it was never really addressed or understood to the extent that who she was as, I mean, of course we know her now, but I think I felt that in particular mental illness is such a misunderstood issue and oftentimes misdiagnosed, and certainly has brought many, many, many many humans, but many women to the point of isolation, and in some cases, in the case of schizophrenia, which is where I've decided to bring our Violetta character to suicide. So I thought it was an important issue to then weave into a young girl having come to New York City to find her life and the challenges that she has in the ongoing battle with schizophrenia, delusions, and all of the other challenges that come up with shame and isolation that are commonly experienced by those with schizophrenia and other mental illnesses. I don't know if your audience is aware, but the statistics show that young adults between 18 and 22 are most commonly stricken with the delusions and depression that accompany schizophrenia. They could have it younger, but this is the age during college many times where it begins to escalate. I also fell upon a TED talk with an incredible woman, young woman who's tremendously successful at MIT, and the name of it is "I'm Not a Monster." And she talks about what it means to be stricken with schizophrenia and all of what happened to her. She also, of course, tried to commit suicide a number of times, but she explains how she came out of that, and that being a woman, in addition to having this illness, the first response that she had to herself was, no, don't tell anybody because it'll be shameful and what will other people think? So this interview was talking about the importance of her voice being heard, and all women, and certainly women that are stricken with this illness, to talk about what it means in their life and reach out for the help that they need. So I thought that bringing the Traviata story to, I can start to explain a little bit of my premise. I start the entire opera with Violetta in it's a two-storied set that I have, and the upper story is her room at Bellevue Psychiatric Hospital. And so as we open the opera in the prelude, Violetta is looking down on her apartment, and then the other side is the Café Parigi, which is basically Bar Paris. And looking, and I think as the audience beginning to wonder, did this ever happen? Did my life happen? How did it happen? Am I where I am now, or where has this led me? And the premise of my opera is to tell the story through her eyes from this perspective. So it's challenging in the sense that, of course, explaining how I'm going to theatrically with lighting and the music bring this to life. Of course, I'd love my audiences to come and see it for themselves.
Absolutely.
I can't totally explain it all, but
indeed, we want to give a little taste so that we can get our audience out there. And
great.
A quick question. Do you plan on videotaping this so that it can be seen by others around the world?
Yes. Luckily, the orchestra is not union, so we are allowed to videotape it, and we will be able to have that available, you know, upon editing and so forth at some point, at least maybe through the internet or a Facebook Live, or we're still trying to work out what will work out in that regard. But we absolutely want it recorded. It's such a new concept. And of course, for my own archival, purposes, I would also like to have it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's so good to hear. So our listeners out there, if you can't get here to see the production, which is going to be coming up September 9th and September 10th in Deal, New Jersey, and we'll recap that a little bit more at the end of the show. But would this be a good moment to, we would like to bring two clips of a couple of the pieces into the feature today. Would this maybe mm-hmm. be a good moment to bring one of those in, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the production in between?
Absolutely. The first clip that we chose is the very, very famous Libiamo, which is the toast of all the characters as they're celebrating life, and Violetta and Alfredo meet for the first time. This is actually in the traditional production in Paris, but in my production, it's in Club Parigi. So it's an underground club in New York City that Violetta and her friends arrange parties in, and Alfredo comes in at that moment. And so one of the first things that we see about Alfredo and Violetta together is them just toasting to life and being together with all their friends. The soprano, Ashley Bell, who will be in our production as well, is the soprano in this particular clip.
And that was the toast. Wonderful. Please tell us a little bit more about that scene, Andrea.
So the toast is pretty traditional in terms of the way that I present it in the production. However, we begin to see Violetta, the main character, she starts to display some pieces, some parts of the break in the schizophrenia. However, we also understand that she has this inner strength, an inner strength even with the mental illness, that's almost more together than the characters around her. Alfredo and the father, I have them as characters that are very wealthy businessmen, and his son from Connecticut, and again the other aspects of society that does not necessarily bring them to an honest place. And as we go through the production, in the next clip that we're going to play, Violetta is in the club and Alfredo is in front of everyone, decided to humiliate her. He's drunk. She's left him, but as the story unfolds, none of that was actually her doing. But instead of the story, her letting him know, she's kept it to herself. So he throws money. He calls her, you know, a prostitute. And in this scene, traditionally, Violetta really looks like the victim, and she's on the floor and she's crying and people are taking care of her. And in my production, she has one line in the opera that says, no matter what happens, these men are never going to change. So in this particular scene, she actually stands up, and instead of embracing Alfredo, she pushes him, as well as pushes the Baron and says, get out of my life. I don't need a man. And I think it's a huge shift. It's a huge change in terms of, you know, regardless of the ending, which obviously is not happy. It is La Traviata. I really couldn't change that part. But we see this inner strength of Violetta. And I think we need to talk more often about, again, we're not victims. It's not meant to be even called upon, this art form, as women as victims. But I think it's traditionally sort of directed that way. So this particular ensemble again features Ashley Bell as Violetta, and it's spectacular music. But listen for all those high floating lines where she's declaring who she is, and you could hear her above the entire ensemble.
Yes, it's an incredible stories to be listened to through this production. And you mentioned the influence of Sylvia Plath to this production. And I understand you have a quote that is pretty relevant. Do you like to share?
I do. Yes, I do. And this quote, I decided to actually put it in the opera. And Violetta in the hospital actually, she says this quote before the action starts in the club and in the apartment. We have a little longer version of it, but I'd like to just read a small part of the beginning. And again, this is told through the eyes of Violetta. I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I lift my lids and all is born again. I think I made you up inside my head. Sylvia Plath. So it very much talks about the life that Sylvia herself, of course, lived in her head, and Violetta is as well, and speaks directly to the delusion. So I utilize quite often, in fact, Violetta in her hospital bed is holding a copy of The Bell Jar. Mm. So I feel that's a beautiful way to really bring us to where Violetta is. I've told my actresses a number of times, I said, that book, The Bell Jar, is your teddy bear. That is a sense of security for you. You're relating to this incredibly talented, wonderful woman, Sylvia Plath. And that we see that a number of times within the production itself as the story unfolds.
Incredible. It's very poignant and important part of this production, I can tell. And the comparison of what you're doing with this version of La Traviata, bringing the feminist sensibility to the stage, reinterpreting the opera and the parallels to women's vulnerability in all societies around the world. You know, our need for awareness and solidarity within our community versus isolating ourselves. So
absolutely, you know, one of my favorite researcher writers is Brené Brown. I love her, and whenever I myself am feeling like, oh, I need a friend, or I need, you know, I just turn on one of her podcasts and listen, or I read from, you know, Daring Greatly, and I gain myself as a woman just so much hope and strength and resilience in hearing the voices of other women, as you say, and being part of the community as opposed to isolating. And I think that that's very much a huge part of what I'm trying to bring out in this production.
Well, brava. And I would love to hear this second clip that we have for today's show, if you could lead us into that.
So it is the Act Two party, and I'm actually doing La Traviata in two acts instead of three. It's just the way that I'm sort of combining the story. And in Act Two, this is the party where Alfredo comes in drunk in my production and humiliates Violetta, and she, through her tremendous strength and resilience, stands up to him in this absolutely fantastic ensemble with Ashley Bell as Violetta.
Thank you.
was incredible piece to hear, the famous finale in the La Traviata. So, Andrea, please tell us a little bit more how that transitions into the rest of the opera.
Yes, you know, I really do want to mention that there's no director on earth that does not fully need and appreciate and welcome an incredible assistant director. And I have a wonderful assistant director by the name of Thomas Netter. He's a student actually at the Neighborhood Playhouse Theater, and he's been so essential in working with all of the singers as actors, as opposed to just opera singers who stand and sing and don't act. And the process of bringing these characters, who I've completely changed. I mean, I would tell you that the characters are, again, updated New York friends or new people that they're meeting. And I've challenged many singers' idea of the character. For instance, the character of Germont, that's the father of Alfredo. It traditionally in the production, of course, he's very hard on Violetta, and he asks her to leave Alfredo because she's going to make a bad name for the family because she's not a woman of respect. And in this production, as it moves on, when he finds out that she's ill, he becomes, you know, sorry and so forth. Well, I just said, he's not sorry. And I said to Jonathan, I said, I believe that he is narcissistic and has the intention for only what he wants, just to protect the reputation of what he thinks his family needs. So I've asked Jonathan and I challenged him to bring this character to a place that he doesn't get to be off the hook for what he did. And it's been wonderful to watch that, you know, Jonathan went that far and has brought this character to a whole new level for himself. It warms my heart when I hear the singers come and say, I'm so grateful to be part of this production. It's really made me dig inside to understand what I do and I don't know about myself, or how I feel about this, or who is Violetta. You know, why does she fight back? So it's been exciting for myself and Thomas Netter to challenge the singers and the actors through the whole process. And I'm feeling great about the result, and I'm sort of chomping at the bit to hear the audience's response, obviously.
Indeed, I imagine you are, and I look forward to being a part of that experience and feedback. And it's wonderful to hear that you are working with extraordinary practitioners, and that value the perspective women bring to the directorial mm-hmm. lens that you're doing. And it must be a tremendous experience to see how these young practitioners sort of evolve and think of things differently.
And well, I always, obviously, too, I've been where they are. I've been on the stage all my life. So to come from the other direction and respectfully hear how they feel about something, or what their perspective is, and then develop it together, has been so rewarding on both sides.
That's great. And, you know, International Women Artists Salon is all about bringing people together to help raise up women's voices in the creative realm. And so it's wonderful to hear of the work that you're doing, and look forward to doing much more with you in the future and following along your work as a director mm-hmm. and getting your feedback as to how that, you know, the roles of a woman director in opera world is evolving.
Well, I'm so thrilled to know about this organization, and you will be hearing a lot from me because I plan to enthusiastically come on board. And as I say, my next generation, my daughter at Northwestern, I've got a lot of young women who are very, very excited to work and, again, collaborate with the Salon.
Fantastic. I cannot wait. And now I want to make sure that we get all the information out to our listeners. How we can connect with you and follow you ongoing, and give us the details of the performances coming up.
So the New York Opera Collaborative only has a Facebook page. We don't have a website yet. So the Facebook access to New York Opera Collaborative, of course, is the best way. We do have information regarding the production on September 9th and 10th at the Axelrod Theater. I want to also thank Andrew DiPrisco, who's been producing the opera and so excited about the concept and very supportive of everything that we're doing. And then we'll have other projects scattered throughout the year. There'll be a Macbeth at the end of September. We're planning our spring production now, and then I'll have the Narni production announced sometime in the next 2 or 3 months. So that Facebook page is probably the best place to check. In terms of reaching me, I do have a website, www.andreadelgiudice.com. It's just my name, which gives a little bit more information about me, where I've come from, and what other parts of my life are after directing. And I think there's a way to contact me through the collaborative, but of course my direct contact information is also on my website.
Great, and we will make sure that we have all of these links up on our podcast, which is on Podbean, and also on our International Women Artists Salon fan page, and be giving you shout outs through our other social media and
our blog spot.
And Andrea DelGiudice, it's been wonderful to have you on Salon Radio today and to learn about this amazing reinvented production of La Traviata.
Thank you so much, Heidi. What a pleasure it's been to speak with you today.
And it's been our pleasure and honor, and we'll look forward to seeing you in a week or so, and hopefully having you back on Salon Radio in the future to learn more about
your
ongoing projects.
Great, I would love to.
So break
okay,
a leg.
Thank you so much.
Do you say break a leg in the opera world?
Oh, we sure do.
All right.
We sure do.
Great, break a leg to
thank
all.
You.
Take care. And today's sponsor spot is featuring Funkadelic Studios. As I mentioned earlier in the show, we are now recording our podcast at Funkadelic Studios, and I'm going to let Maureen tell us more about this great organization.
Funkadelic Studios runs on a simple philosophy: the musicians are the priority. Funkadelic Studios has provided musicians an affordable home to rehearse, record, and reinvent their music for over 20 years. Two musician friends in Brooklyn started the studio as a way to connect with the NYC music scene and provide a place where musicians can do what they do best, make music. No matter how rich, poor, established, or underground an artist might be, Funkadelic provides all the services musicians need under one roof. The six R's are essential for any artist, and Funkadelic has them all covered: rehearsal rooms, recording studio, repair shop, rentals, retail shop, and a rock and roll club. Beyond rehearsal and recording, Funkadelic provides other great outlets for artists to showcase their work: open mic nights, open jams, event showcases, EP album release parties, and talent competitions are only a few of an extensive list of services we provide musicians to help network and promote their art. Funkadelic takes the extra step to help the music community keep in contact with their fans, other musicians, and industry professionals. Funkadelic Studios understands that music isn't just about a group of songs or compositions. It is about people. People who write the music, people who help with the technical aspects, and people who listen to it. For a full list of services, you can visit their website at funkadelicstudios.com.
Thank you, Maureen. And now we're going to have our section of Salon Bulletin, which will let you know, our listeners, what is happening by Salonistas, our members around the world, upcoming this week. So I'm going to bounce it right back to you, Maureen.
Hey, Salonistas. Maureen here again, bringing you the Salon Bulletin of upcoming events. We have Twisted Lipstick Comedy, featuring the funniest all-female lineup of diverse stand-up comics nationwide and beyond. The show is going to be hosted by Salonista Mutia Vision, featuring Allie Lethbridge, Whitney Channel Clark, Lois Thompson, Janelle Jackson, Catherine Cypher. They have happy hour first. That starts at 6. The doors open at 7. Showtime is at 8 o'clock. That is at Sir D's Lounge, 837 Union Street in Brooklyn. And you can get your tickets on Eventbrite. It's $10. Twisted-lipstick-comedy-tickets. Take the 2 or 3 train to Grand Army Plaza. That's every second Friday of the month, so their next show is going to be Friday, September 8th. We also have More Artivism by Salinista Paula Billups. In response to the racist violence in Charlottesville, beginning August 13th, Paula started a 30-day series of small works, making one a day and listing it on her Etsy page. Works are priced between $10 and $100, and the total sale price of all works sold from the Art for Charlottesville series will be donated to the Southern Poverty Law Center in a lump sum on September 14th. As Paula says, buy art, fight Nazis, win-win. That's at Paula Billups Art, PaulaBillupsart, and that's on Etsy.com. We also have a part of IRT's 3B development series coming up. And this is a show written and directed by our own Salinista, Ran Jha. And it is called Pomegranate. And the story revolves around Persephone. She gets snatched to the underworld, but the place isn't really what she expected. Hades has his own problems to deal with as well, especially when the memory archive is at capacity with the refugees pouring into the world of the dead. It's featuring Zoe Ibuyuan, Diane Chen, Jess Davis, Marcellus Galanis, Sean Henkel, Finn Kilgore, Lizzie Anna Lincoln, Andrea Negret, Yara Sagsford, and Sarah Gwynn Walker, and Marie Zumanigui. Associate director is Julia Levine. Assistant directors Jake Beckhardt and Charlotte Arnoux. Music by Emily Krauss, fight choreography by Madeline Emmerich, and the Dispatch Combat Collective. Set design by Julie A. Solomon, lighting design by Elizabeth M. Stewart. That is a show filled with women artists. Pomegranate performs on Wednesday 9/13 at 8, Friday the 15th at 8, Saturday the 16th at 8, which is their official opening. It will also be on Sunday the 17th at 2, Wednesday the 20th at 8, Friday the 22nd, 8, Saturday the 23rd at 2, Sunday the 24th at 7, and you can find them on brownpapertickets.com/event/298-7297. Ran Jha is an interdisciplinary dramatist and co-founder of the Artic Group. IRT Theater is a grassroots laboratory for independent theater and performance in New York City, providing space and support to new generation of artists. They are in the old archive building in Greenwich Village at 154 Christopher Street. So if you have a chance, get on out there and see Pomegranate. That's it for our Salon Bulletin.
Thank you, Maureen. And again, as you can hear, there's amazing creative work being done by Salonistas around the world, all our current members. And if you're interested in joining us, a woman creative of any age, any discipline, anywhere around the world, please contact us at womenartsalon@gmail.com or on our social media outlets. And now I'm going to introduce Jenny Green, who is an amazing artist, actor in her own right, and she's going to be presenting today's second guest, Jocelyn Arem.
And welcome to our second fabulous feature in Salon Radio's double feature extravaganza this week. And we have the wonderful Jocelyn Arem, who is a Grammy-nominated artist, and has a gig coming up and a new album to launch the album. So I'm just going to try and read a little bit from Joss's bio. She actually performs as Rabasi Joss. She'll correct my pronunciation in a minute if I've damaged that in any way. And she's a Brooklyn-based soul, jazz, folk singer, songwriter, inspired by working with award-winning multimedia documentary music projects and crossing paths with such legends as Pete Seeger, Tim Robbins, Jane Fonda and Dr. Bernice Johnson. And now you're returning to the stage and studio before as a performing and recording artist. Awesome!
Woo! Thanks for having me.
Welcome to the studio. Welcome to Brick as well. This is our first recording in the Brick studio.
Love being here at Brick.
Yeah, so I'd like to give a big thank you to Joss and our other featured guest today, Grace, for bearing with me with my technical travails, fiddling around with knobs all morning.
Which the creative
process. In some ways, it's a dream. A dream way of spending a post-Labor Day Tuesday. Anyway, yeah, so Joss, tell us how you got started with the whole singing business then.
how I got started with the whole singing business. It feels like I just always had been in the business, you know, of singing. It was always there. I'm sure Grace feels the same way when you're a singer. It's just sort of exists in you. And I remember singing from when I was very, very, very small, you know, on the playground, in the cradle, and all those stories about me singing from a very young age. And then as I grew up, I just continued to participate in anything musical that I could, whether it was musical theater in high school. Grace and I both have that background, to then in college starting to perform my own music and write my own music and then perform out in coffee houses and clubs. So it's just an evolution.
Cool. And do you come from a musical family?
I do, actually. My great-grandmother was an opera singer. And I have cousins who were in a punk band in the 80s in San Francisco. So the music is all kind of in there. And I have younger cousins now who are in their own punk bands. My cousin Nina is in a band called Palberta that was just featured in Rolling Stone. So I'm very proud of her. So it's all in the fam. Yeah.
Cool. I was always quite scared of punks when I was growing up.
First time around.
I don't know.
Tough on the outside, it can be the nicest people. You know.
The music is awesome.
Yeah.
I dig the music, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So so you started off just singing at school and singing in choirs and singing in musical theatre.
Yep.
And then when did you decide to pick up an instrument?
You know, I picked up the guitar when I was probably 16, 17, because I started to realize that I was playing the piano, but pianos were not as mobile. And, and you know, you needed to be able to sing in different locations and sing out, and I didn't want to have to rely on such a large instrument. So the guitar was the next most best portable thing that could have the same kind of stylings and accompaniment that I was looking for. So I picked up the guitar.
And was it always acoustic guitar?
Always acoustic. There was a little point in there where I had like a real cool red cherry red electric, but and that was fun for blues and stuff, but it didn't last too long. I like the funky old school, you know, acoustic, real like raw sounds.
Did you ever think about the banjo?
I don't think I've ever played the banjo. I lived in North Carolina for 7 years, so I had plenty of experience with the banjo. Never really crossed my mind to actually think I could play
sick
it.
Sick of banjo.
My hand doesn't do that claw thing, you know. No, just the guitar and mainly a vocalist, you know.
Yeah. And who was your most influential guitar teacher?
I had a guitar teacher in college named Chuck DeLoya, who is an amazing blues guitarist, and that style always like really resonated with me. I love the blues, and he was probably fed up with me a lot because I didn't always practice the way I should, and kind of been renegade like that and not always the most disciplined. But one thing he did teach me was the beginning of Summertime, and that actually led to me writing the song Flowers and Salt that we're going to be playing at the show on Saturday. And so it was just like learning that an original riff of Summertime and then literally not remembering the rest of it or not being disciplined enough to recall the rest of it in a lesson. And I just decided to write my own song. So yeah, that's the positive thing of being delinquent is sometimes it leads to creativity, turn it into something new.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And did you have an influential singing teacher as well?
I had musical theater teachers all through high school who were great. And, you know, but my musical teachers were mainly like musicians that I listened to on albums and the radio and friends, you know, being influenced by people that I sang with. I'd listened to a lot of Mariah Carey, a lot of Whitney Houston. I'm a child of the 90s, you know, so that was always there.
And belting.
All that belting and, you know, pop, you know, it was what was on the radio. But then I loved Bonnie Raitt. I loved Bonnie Raitt's old records, you know, listening to her sing, and then all musical theater, you know, like Patti LuPone, Bernadette Peters, we were just talking about, you know, there's just something about that kind of style of singing that's,
yeah. Awesome. And do you remember your first gig?
Yes, my first professional gig was on the stage of a small music venue called Cafe Lena, which started me on a 10-year journey to document the venue itself, but I didn't know that at the time. I was actually playing an open mic night there when I was 18, and I played my couple songs that I had been writing like in my college dorm room. I sat down, and the manager came over and said, I'd like to speak to you in my office. And I have a history of being in school and being asked to come to the office, and it's never really been a good thing. So I just assumed I was getting kicked out for something that I did. And she offered me my very first gig.
Awesome. That's actually an interesting story, isn't it, about the Cafe Lena? Could you tell us about what happened there?
Yeah, so after that encounter, and I realized that I was not in trouble, and I was actually being offered my very first professional performance ever at age 18, I started performing regularly there at this tiny little coffee house venue that actually had an incredible history that I wasn't quite aware of at the time, but learned later that performers like Pete Seeger and Bob Dylan and Ani DiFranco and Rufus Wainwright and just these great, Don McLean, these great songwriters in our cultural history had performed on that stage. And it was like hallowed ground for musicians for many, many years. And I looked around and I said, had anyone recorded the story of this place? And no one had. And I asked, could I do that? And I began this documentary project where I started interviewing musicians, I interviewed 150 musicians around the country about their experiences performing there. I got to track down people like Rufus Wainwright and Tim Robbins and speak to them firsthand about their experiences, uncovered 4,000 images of performers playing there, and about 400 shows, recorded shows that no one had ever heard. Wow. And created a book project that was published by Powerhouse Books a couple of years ago with an accompanying CD, 3-CD box set of all of those curated performances. Wow. From the 1960s to today. And as well as a website, a digital database. It won the ASCAP Deems Taylor Award in 2012 for multimedia, and the entire archive then went to be at the Library of Congress.
Nice.
So from that one gig, it led to this extraordinary experience. Yeah. I got to sit at the feet of some of my favorite artists and just learn about their history as musicians.
Cool. And how long did that take, that process?
That entire project took about 12 years, and I was in school for a lot of it, so I was sort of using that experience to understand better what I was learning in school. I was studying ethnomusicology. It was my undergraduate degree, created a self-determined major. And from there went on to do my master's in folklore and cultural studies. And all along the way, I was using this place as like a case study to better understand the real life stories of social activists and musicians and people who had really shaped the cultural musical identity of our country's history in so many ways, had a formative space on this particular stage.
That's amazing. Did you ever think that you would perhaps not get to the end of that project?
There were many, many times that I thought, is this we're ever going to end? But I felt a loyalty to seeing it through because of so many people had shared their stories with me at that point. And a lot of the people I interviewed had passed away. And that's heavy, you know, when you realize that you're carrying stories for people who then, you know, trust you that they're going to see
their legacy.
Exactly. Yeah. They want to make sure that you're going to carry that forward. So I really felt indebted to them. And it was a really special thing when we finally published the book and we had a celebration at Powerhouse Arena, which used to be in Dumbo, with a bunch of the musicians who I had interviewed performing. It was like coming full circle. And then Grace was with me when we recorded this record and performed it on the stage of the cafe, this most recent record. So that was like coming home for me. That was like really the final chapter of that project, was to get to perform my recent record on the stage.
That's amazing. It must have been like unpeeling an onion. So you probably, or something else, something where you think something is quite small, and then suddenly the more you go into it, the more you realize how huge and vast it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then also the technology was evolving a lot as you were going through it. How did that work out?
Yeah, it's interesting you should say that, because I look back at pictures now when I first interviewed people, and I had a little cassette interview recorder, you know, like I was using cassette tapes, and then eventually I transitioned to using digital, but I still have all those old cassettes.
Wow.
That I did my very first interviews on. And then the kind of media that we uncovered from the recorded history of the cafe was everything from reel-to-reel tape to cassettes to digital. So it, like, Steve Rosenthal, who owned the Magic Shop Studio, helped me digitize all of this recorded material. I used to say it was like a history of the recorded tape of, you know, because we were uncovering recorded sound. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Because you must, I mean, I guess when you started, you wouldn't really have known where it was going to end up. You just wanted to document this history.
Yeah.
And then the means of actually doing that evolved, and then the final products were probably not what you thought they were going to be when you started.
Yeah, I, I knew I wanted to do a book because the founder had wanted to see a book of all the stories, and then the music came later, the recorded music came later. But no, for me, it was always like a window into the world of music, and it was a way to experience firsthand storytelling in a way that I knew I couldn't just by going to school. I'm sure Grace feels the same way. Like, yeah, when you're performing and we're out in the world, you learn so much more than sometimes you do in a classroom. It's all valuable, but that real life experience is huge. Yeah. So it taught me a lot about the kind of artist that I wanted to be and the kind of music that I wanted to make just from listening, from listening to the stories.
And you could probably make a lot of money now by redoing all those tapes.
Redoing?
Well, if you actually issue the tapes, because they're
remastering,
because hipsters like old-fashioned audio.
Oh, those hipsters and their
cassettes. It's all about money.
Analog is always coming back, making a return.
So can you share any of those stories with us?
Any of the stories from that project?
Yeah.
Oh gosh, there's so many.
Well, who kind of struck you as particularly amazing? I mean, it sounds like you met some fabulous people. I can't imagine any of them were disappointing. But which memories live with you today?
Oh my goodness, it's going to take me a minute to think about retrack all of those people I sat down with.
Who were you mm-hmm. especially honored to meet? Who was your kind of biggest heroine or hero that you met?
You know, I tried to be as, you know, I'm not just tried, but I knew I needed to be as professional as possible when I met with these artists, and I had to put on my documentarian hat to be, as professional as possible. But there were some musicians that I remember wanting to tell them how much their music meant to me, and knowing that I needed to be careful about not geeking out, you know, as a music fan and still being professional. But one of those artists was Greg Brown, who I'm a huge fan of. He's just an incredible songwriter. I'd listened to his music a lot. And we just did a phone interview, and he was very, very nice to me at the end of the interview. And I said in my most professional manner, Mr. Brown, Greg, I just want to tell you how much I love your music. And he was very, very, very gracious. And Ani DeFranco was another one of those who I actually got to sit down with and talk to in person, and was very, very sweet to me. So funny. I didn't realize how funny she would be in person. And she was very, very kind. And then Pete Seeger, you know, to sit down with him in his home just a few years before he died, and his wife Toshi was still alive at that point, brought us tea. And speaking of banjos, you know, he's very famous for playing his banjo. You know, and we were sitting in his living room and just talking about, you know, his life and the cafe and everything. It was such an honor just to be sitting in his presence. It's like he could have said anything, you know, but he was just so wise. And I remember this huge window behind him, and it was wintertime, and there were trees, like evergreen trees, that were covered with snow. And he was wearing a little strawberry hat, like a knit strawberry hat. Mm-hmm. It was really sweet. And then at one point he was telling the story, and it just like naturally evolved into, and I'm going to take down my banjo and start to play a song. And we like sat there with our mouths open, like, is this really happening? He's actually playing for us. And it was very natural, you know, people just exploring and evolving with their music. And it was just an easy afternoon. It was just very, very sweet.
Yeah, sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
Cool. So, yeah, after that he must have been filled with inspiration to create your own work, and you have a new album coming out. It's not a debut album, is it?
It's a debut album for Rabasi Joss. Rabasi Joss is my new stage name, and I had recorded some earlier music, but this is really the first big project, and it was produced by Baba Israel, who has a band called Soul Inscribed that Grace Gallu to my left is now a new part of. And Baba and I actually first met at Cafe Lina. He and his wife were doing a summer poetry workshop, and we connected. He's someone who is, you know, really interested in music tradition, as am I, and we were interested in exploring, you know, the history of music that had come before us in order to make our music deeper and better. And I asked him to produce this record. It's called Heliotrope, and we just came out with it in May.
Awesome. Well, I'm very excited that we're going to be hearing a track from it shortly.
Yeah.
But before we do, let's talk to Grace.
Hello.
Hello, Grace. So let me just read a little bit from your bio down here as well. Grace Gallu. So you are a vocalist, guitarist and composer who combines the sounds of your Irish and Congolese heritage with a soulful and gritty twist.
Yes.
And she's also an excellent ad hoc engineer as well. And you have, you've used your background and your New York City upbringing to forge a wide range of musical ability. And you were also into musical theatre.
Yes.
And you went to Tadar.
I did go to Tadar.
Yeah, that's so much fun. A few people have done that. That's
yeah, cool. I went there as a child, and it was really just such a wonderful experience. I gained a lot of poise.
I can see you can balance a lot of books on your
head. posture is really important in my family. But yes, Tadar was where I first started performing and understanding all the mechanisms behind theater. So not just about being in the forefront, but also about understanding how to support a cast and learning what a director does and what a stage manager does and what a composer does. So it was a fantastic place for a child.
Yeah. I didn't realize how long, I mean, I'm not saying you're old, but I didn't realize that...
it's been around as long as it has. I believe it started in the late 70s.
Wow.
Yeah, by the time I had started there, it had been around for a while. And, you know, I'm 30 now. So, yeah, it's been around quite a while.
Cool.
And they're still going.
Yeah. So you really started in the musical theatre tradition.
Yes, I went to a Catholic school that put on these fantastic musicals where pretty much everyone in the school was involved. And Baruch Theater got interested in our musicals because they were so huge, and they started letting us do our musicals in their auditorium. So from a really young age, I was performing on, you know, a huge stage, like college level type performances.
Yeah.
So I was blessed in that sense.
What was your favorite part?
Oh, I played the Mother Abbess in The Sound of Music.
Amazing! What was your best song in that? I don't know.
Well, that's Climb else. Every Mountain,
oh,
of course.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
I did a cover of it recently after this election. I needed to console myself.
That's amazing.
So I did it, and I actually, you know, I felt like I was singing to my younger self.
Mm, that's
beautiful. Or maybe my younger self was singing to me. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's all come around somewhere.
Yeah, it's come full circle. But I, as Josh said, joined this band, Soul Inscribed, recently. And I'd been, you know, rubbing elbows with these guys for a long time in the poetry and performance scene and, you know, the open mic and underground scene. But recently they were looking for a vocalist to work on another project, a play. And through that, I met Baba, and through Baba, I met Rabasi Joss.
Ah, so it's quite a recent acquaintance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been together for about 6 months.
Together.
It's a new partnership. Quite flirtatious.
It feels longer than that. It's crazy. Yeah, like twin souls.
Yeah. When you find, you know, when you've been around and you're experiencing enough stuff, when you find the right things,
yes,
and you know magic's going
to
happen.
Yeah, so I was able to go to Cafe Lena with Joss,
mm-hmm,
this spring. So I was able to experience some of the history that she was, you know, speaking of. And then I was able to perform with her at her album release party in May,
mm-hmm, cool,
at BAM across the street.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, we come back home again.
Yeah.
Always returning home to Brooklyn.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
No sleep till Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. That's awesome. Did you grow up in Brooklyn?
I actually grew up in Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
My mother's from Brooklyn. My grandmother's from Brooklyn. My great-grandmother's from Brooklyn, in the Park Slope area. But I grew up in Manhattan, and I've lived in every borough except for Staten Island, knock on wood.
is that to go or to not go?
That's to not go.
I hope I get there.
We do apologize for any Staten Island listeners.
You know what? It's not their fault. I forgive them.
Oh, man. That's hilarious.
They've got some kind of heritage there. So we talked there a little bit about your drawing from your Irish and Congolese heritage.
Yes.
How does that kind of play into the musician that you are today?
Well, they both have such a rich musical folk lore and just such a strong identity. And bizarrely, because they're such different cultures, there's so many similarities.
Mm.
So, in fact, my dad loves listening to Celtic, like, beautiful, eerie, harmonic songs. And my mom was the one buying us Zap Mama and, you know, all the Congolese songs. And the immersion of the two, I really feel like, is a unique thing that I've honed in on.
Yeah.
A combination of rhythm, syncopation, and then just, like, these, like, haunting harmonies.
Mm.
So I really feel lucky that I have that that background, and then everything in between.
Yeah.
You know, and my parents are eclectic music listeners, and you know, definitely exposed me at a young age to a quality of music.
Yeah, they're both fantastic traditions. I don't know very much about Congolese dance, but are you a fan of Irish step dancing?
I am. I am a fan of Irish step dancing. And it's funny because that's where the differences lie. Irish step dancing is very much from below the waist. Mm. And Congolese dancing is all about the waist.
Mm.
You're just moving your waist. And there's this saying, you know, that people in Northern Africa dance with their shoulders. And in Central Africa, you dance with your hips. And in Southern Africa, you dance with your legs.
Oh.
So the Congo is right in the Central Africa, and it's all about the hips. Male, female, child, grandmother. You got to shake that.
So all the hips. So you've got
to move those hips. Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. And will we see any dance when you perform?
Absolutely. I can't help it.
And you're doing some percussion as well, I think.
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm. My husband and I, my husband's a percussionist, but we were doing classes with children, so we have collected all of these hand percussion, you know, just for the fun of being able to participate in a group sing-along. And because of the environment, on Saturday is going to be quite intimate and mm-hmm. kind of like a group setting.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it'd be nice to bring some hand percussion along to set that environment.
Yeah. The So Far show that we're doing is all acoustic.
All acoustic.
On Saturday.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
So tell us about the ones you brought with you today.
Well, these are gourds that are actually filled with dried
balls.
Seeds. Yeah, my fancy balls. And this is somewhat of a rainmaker. You know, it has a slide to it. It's you know has a higher pitch,
mm-hmm.
and it you know has a bit more of a shake to it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And together they create a good look.
They do. I'm seeing some symbolism there. If you can imagine that, maybe. Cool. Okay. Well, maybe we should listen to the song.
Mm,
do you
okay.
want to should we talk about it after you sing it, or do you want to talk about it before you sing it?
I'll just introduce it quickly, and then you can ask us questions about it afterwards. It's called Heliotrope. It is the title track of the record, Heliotrope. It half away, would you write it in a song? Would you leave it at my feet and slowly walk away? Would you leave it at my feet and walk away? We're so wrong size, so we don't fit in any drawer. Nothing's big enough to hold us anymore. You said if we swim long and hard enough, we just might find some shore. So it goes, so it goes, so it goes. And I hear your throat. You're the dark blue to my deep breath. All the poetry that neither you or me, if I have ever said, I'm just looking for a peaceful place where I can lay my head. So it goes, so it goes, so it goes, and I hear the intro. Hear the intro to me. Heliotrope to me. Heliotrope to me. Heliotrope. If the right thing fell away, would you write it on your head to remember us?
us this way, oh babe. I am so sorry for the way that I behave. But when I love you, I promise to do it delicately. And you hear the trumpets to me. Hear the trumpets to me.
Joss, that you do have a thing about words as well. So for those of us that don't know what a heliotrope is, what is that?
Heliotrope is what plants do when they're reaching for the light. And this is something that my mom taught me, and she has a real green thumb and has always grown a lot of plants. And she always used to say that when you're growing plants, you should keep turning the pot so that the plant continued to grow along towards the light. And I just became fascinated with this topic. I just thought it was the most beautiful metaphor for the way that people are driven to pursue their creativity, especially artists. And it was at a time when I was really trying to regain my own connection to myself as a creative artist. I had been doing this documentary work for Cafe Lena and then for the Errol Garner Jazz Project over the last like 15 years. You know, I gave so much of my life to storytelling for other artists. And I sort of at a certain point found that I was losing my own creativity, my own personal artistic creativity in that, you know, my connection to my own music. And I found that I needed to come back to some kind of balance between my own work and the work that I was creating for other people. And it felt really good to return to that and discover what that was all about. So heliotrope is really that idea of connectivity to the light that inspires us.
Cool. That's the title track of the album.
That's the title track of the record.
It's very beautiful.
Yeah, and we actually had a guest pianist, the late Jerry Allen, play on that track. So it's really special now for me to hear that back because we lost Jerry this last year. So it's been really an emotional journey to have played with these amazing artists and then to, you know, realize that they may not be around forever. So again, just like this, similar to the documentary work that I did, just really appreciating the creative artists that we surround ourselves with every day.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. So we only have a couple of minutes left, I think. It's been wonderful to have you on. I also wanted to ask you what the Rabassi bit of Rabassi Joss.
Sure. Rabassi is comes from a childhood nickname. My middle name is Rose, so when I was a kid, it was Rabassi, like Jocko Rabassi, Jocelyn Rose, and I decided to keep the Joss because a lot of my friends know me as Joss, and then I decided to make the Rabassi the first part of that, and I really dig it.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's very intriguing. And then your whole thing with Cafe Lena and Errol Garner has evolved into a business, which is how we first met, the Creative Entrepreneurs Project at the Artist Fund, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And that has a fantastic name as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I like words, you know, and like making up words and thinking about the origin of words. And Arbo Radico, the name of my company, comes from tree root. Arbo is tree and radico is root. I like the
In Esperanto,
which is like a, you know, meant to be a universal language. It was all, I was just doing research about like this linguistic history, and I found that I really loved all the meanings of those the words together. And I love the connotation of radico and radical. You know, this kind of idea that like by revisiting history, it's like a radical act, and we're always transforming history, making it new. So I love that for root. And Arbo Radico is a company that reimagines archival content and transforms it into modern day projects, right, to highlight the history of the arts, creative arts.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Thank you.
So tell us how we can find out more about your gig on Saturday.
So you can actually go to my website, Rabassi Joss, RABASIJOSS, and all the information about the Sofar Sounds gig is on there. You can also go to the Sofar website. I believe it's sofarsounds.com or
yes.
Google Sofar. And then if you go to the September 9th Chinatown location, it's a secret showcase, so we cannot say the exact location. You'll get emailed that the day before, but if you sign up, then you'll find out how to do all of that.
Bye.
exciting.
Yes. Very exciting.
The secret makes it better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Oh,
yes.
Yes. Oh, hush, hush. Yep. You heard from here first. I know you've played it with places. Yeah. Well, I think that's all we've got time for.
Thank you
so much. We'll also have all those details on the Women Artists Salon website as well, so you can find out more then. So thank you very much,
thank you,
Joss, and thank you very much, Grace.
Thank you.
It's been great having you on board.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, check out Heliotrope. And is it available on iTunes to download?
It's available on all of the digital platforms. And well,
is it available on analog tape, perhaps?
We have. Not analog, not cassette for you hipsters. You're going to have to get creative with that. But we have CDs available on Saturday. And I have tote bags that are called Heliototes. Oh! That are pretty snazzy. You got to come get a Heliotote. So, yeah. You can purchase those on Bandcamp and at the gig on Saturday.
Awesome. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
I've been Jenny Green, and this is Salon Radio. Goodbye.
Thank you, Jenny, for bringing Jocelyn to Salon Radio today. Thank you, Jocelyn. It's great to hear about your work. And thank you again to Andrea Del Giudice, who is director of La Traviata and founder artistic director of New York Opera Collaborative earlier on in our show. And we look forward to following both of their careers. And now we'd like to say thank you for listening to us today and being a fan of Salon Radio and following and supporting women's artistry around the world. Again, you can follow us on International Women Artists Salon Facebook page, also our YouTube channel, and our shorter Twitter and Instagram at Women Art Salon. So we look forward to having you follow us, sending us a message, and being engaged for raising up women's artistry around the world. Thank you, and see you next week.